This is case 10 of the Moon Con. Seizei is utterly destitute, or also called Seizei the Poor. Seizei says to Suzan, Seizei is utterly destitute. Will you give him support? Suzan says, you have finished 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say you have not yet moistened your lips? That's one translation. Katsuki Sakita, and here's another one. A monk, Seizei, eagerly asked Master Suzan, I am solitary and poor. I beg you, Master, please help me become prosperous. Suzan said, Venerable Seizei. Yes, Master, replied Seizei. Suzan said, you've already drunk 3 cups of fine Hakka wine, and still you say that you have not yet moistened your lips. Muman's comment is, Seizei pretended to retreat. What was his scheme? Suzan had the eye of the Buddha and saw through his opponent's motive. However, I want to ask you, at what point did Seizei drink wine? Which is a question for us to. So, just who are these guys? Suzan was the successor to Tozan, which is convenient because their names rhymed, and they actually made them. His name is made up out of Tozan. And Tozan founded the Soto lineage. So these guys are right there. Seizei was Sozan's help her monk as Soto lineage was being formed. And that's one of the last, you know, 2 major schools of Zen. It was, I didn't know this until recently, it was called the peasant school, as opposed to the Rinzai, which are the elite school. So I just want you peasants to know that. So,
can you remind me which one is the school that is known for the koans? Is it the peasant
that's
school
actually the Rinzai school, but we're not practicing, we're not Rinzai.
Yeah, but we're doing the koans that Rinzai established.
Right, and we do them in a different way.
Okay.
You're allowed to study the koans or let them interpenetrate with your being and then respond to them. In Rinzai school, you go in and they fire koans at you.
Oh, wow.
2 or 3 or 4 or 5, and it's called the school of sudden insight, in the sense it's meant to disrupt the regular thought patterns so that you're plunged into enlightenment. So these are considerable guys. And Seizei apparently at the time was well known in Zen circles, but we don't have any other record of him other than the fact that he was engaged in this Dharma combat with his master. And it's clear that this is not, Joe Schmo coming to ask a question like, I'm really poor. What can I do? Can you help me get rich? Like some forms of religion help you get rich. Not this one. So when he says, I'm poor or I'm utterly destitute, he's not referring to his income level or how many cars he has or doesn't have. He's talking about having shed desire and distinctions. So no more good and evil, no more heaven and hell, no more even samadhi. He's beyond those distinctions, he's saying. And yet, he's asking this question of his master, or the person who became his master. It's not clear. Maybe to see if he can skewer him, or to see whether there was anything beyond where he had arrived. Having gone to the other side, essentially. He's, thoroughly realized person. So if I'm poor already, what more can I have? And so Zen has an answer to him. You've already been living in Napa Valley, and you have been swinging the finest. What's the finest wine in Napa Valley? I don't know.
Gallo.
No, you haven't touched Gallo in a while. But you have been, you know, you have been drinking the nectar of the gods. Haka was the wine district in China. So, and then at this Seizei is enlightened. What's he saying there? What's he trying to bring across to Seizei, who feels in one way that he's utterly realized? You've been drinking wine. And of course in Zen, you know, drinking wine is not, you know, that's an intoxicating beverage. And he's saying to this guy, you've been swigging it, you're drunk, you know, you drank three glasses, you know, you're over the limit. So Seizei has had his lunch handed to him. He thought he had it, and so Zen is telling him that he's not beyond all of these things. And in what sense is he not beyond? And that's the one, that's what I want to consider today. And then I want to look at, I mean, you could say how to have your wine and not drink it too. Would be what I'm proposing to us today. And we've got a few poems that use drunkenness as a metaphor or as a condition of being. So Zen is reminding him that in this world you can't stay sober or poor. Because what happens in this world happens to all of us. And at any time, you have eyes. On the way over here this morning, I listened to Andre Agassi talk about his career and how thoroughly he was fueled by anger and revenge. I mean, his entire life was given over to revenge. And I didn't get, the title of his book is Open, which implies that at some point he gets over that. But Deborah, who had a longer drive and arrived later, got the chance to hear the end of it, where he goes through to another dimension of his being. But I was left with Andre Agassi saying, I wanted to kill Boris Becker, and I did. And then at the end of it, end of this great epical match, I didn't shake hands with him. And I'm thinking to myself, that really appeals to something in me, like, fuck you, you know, I am going to beat you. You badmouth me, I'm going to kill you. And so there I am. I'm drinking the wine. And it's very difficult not to drink the wine when there's so much of that kind of wine around. The wine of anger. You know, the wine of pleasure, too. So, Emily Dickinson has a phrase for how to live with this. And it's called sumptuous destitution. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I wanted to say something I thought we might have a service today, but I, you know, it's not, he's not really a Zen guy at all. But Galloway Cannell, who was a wonderful American poet, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award and MacArthur Fellowship, and was a very influential poet on me and lots of other people. He just died a few days ago. And on one of the sites that is connected with him, this poem comes up. Whatever happens, whatever, and there's the phrase in italics here, what is, okay? Whatever happens, whatever, what is what I want. Whatever, what is what I want. Only that, but that. So, whatever happens, whatever, what is what I want. Only that, but that. So, you think that's Zen?
Yes and no.
Well, you're always safe in saying that. Do you want to elaborate?
So yes, it is. We want what is. We want to be there. At the same time, wanting to be there is the problem. So the key is to want it. My perspective is the key is to want it enough to keep letting go. But at the end, letting go of wanting it is part of what you have to do. So then you're beyond. So that's my thought.
What do you think? What do the rest of you think?
Absolutely.
Did you hear it?
Yeah, one of the few words I heard you say that I heard.
Okay. So I want, you know, what is, first of all, I have to point out as a poet that this poem uses is 3 times in a row and still makes sense. This has perhaps never happened in the history of the universe before. Whatever what is what I want. Only that, but that. So this is a poem written in his old age. Galway Kinnell was a person of enormous appetites and erotic appetites that make him, if erotic appetites were the measure of a poet, he would be nearly one of the greatest poets in the world. But at the end of his life, you know, he's shedding that. And yet he called his relationship to the world imperfect thirst. Imperfect thirst. So he never had that desire, never let go of that desire to have the world, even when it was beyond, or have being as it is without adornment. You could say that that's what he was after. And that's different from both what Sozanne's saying and what Zézé is saying. Zézé is the guy who's asking the question, Sozanne's the guy who's providing him the challenge. I've dropped all my baggage. And Sozanne is saying, nah. Nah. As long as you're here, there's baggage. There's joy, there's everything. There's wine. And this is the wine of being alive. We could look at it, in terms of, like Tibetan Buddhists would call it delusion, but it's also life. And there we are. So, it's a question of what we're drinking and how we're drinking it. You know, are we drinking Sneaky Pete or are we not? I want to jump to the Emily Dickinson poem. The two lines from it that I think are important to it. She says, I taste a liquor never brewed. I'm, bum, bum, bum. I'm a debauchee, that is a debauched, person of dew. I'm stoned on dew. I'm an inebriate of air. And mine is a sumptuous destitution. I tasted liquor, never brewed. I'm an inebriate of air. And mine is a sumptuous destitution. So, Emily Dickinson's saying, living in the confines of this 19th century, deeply circumscribed by an ocean of false consciousness, which was the 19th century and their attitudes towards women. she's choosing to live in her house where she can keep it real. And then her main converse, aside from her sister and her brother-in-law, but her main converse was with the natural world. So there were many refusals for her, including getting published, which was a, she was clearly the greatest poet in America. And whether she knew that or not is really beside the point. But she couldn't get published because the terms in which her poems were published would not have been understood. And it would also have wrecked her. It would not have been good for her. It would have been like Dogon writing a bestseller so he could, so he could get a Cadillac or something for her. She said publication is the auction of the mind. And in the 19th century, an auction meant a slave auction. So for her, drinking the wine of fame or recognition was not something that she wanted to do. She wanted what is. She wanted to be content with the dew, content with the air, content with nothing. But she's not saying, as Cézé seemed to be saying, that I'm done with that. She's saying, that's my wine. That's my wine. The air is my wine. I'm drunk on it. And drunkenness comes in as a metaphor in all religious traditions when trying to figure forth this unnameable presence of emptiness or the divine, however people construe it. And so we can't get utterly clear in this lifetime. We can have these moments of it, but we can't get clear. Just this morning, Jamie brought a book in about the chants that we say in here. And looking at the four vows, creations are numberless, or sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. And he describes this Japanese guy describes those two halves of that as being contradictory. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Well, if they're numberless, you can't get to the end of it and you can't free them. So there's, on the face of it, there's a logical contradiction. And he described then what we're doing is trying to empty the ocean with a teaspoon. And said, therefore, that Zen is for fools. And if you're smart, you'll never get enlightened. And I think what we're talking about there is aspirational, based on our moments of insight. Obama got to be president in no small part because of a speech he made at the, I think it was the convention that nominated Gore. And he gave the speech that he'd been giving the whole time that he was campaigning for Congress, but also even when he was a community organizer. And this drove people wild, including me. I mean, I thought it was just an astonishing speech. But the center of the speech is, when a widow is in her flat and has no heat, we're all diminished. All of us, we're all in it together. And, it's very much, ask not for the for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. So he's saying that we're all in it together, and we have to pay attention to that. And that mystical insight, or that insight that runs through almost all religions, really rang a bell for most liberals, because it accorded with their ideology, but far more deeper than that. It just got to that point where we all have the intuition of that we're one. But then later on, Obama described those thoughts as aspirational. That is very much like a vow we take. So we're not saving every widow. Penniless widows are numberless. there's no end to the penniless widows. And so therefore, we're not failing in the sense of in this aspiration to free all beings, but we are required to keep on practicing, because it's never endless. There's no end to it. And Seizei seems to think, at least with part of his being, or maybe this is just his pretense, that he's gotten to the end of it, that he's poor, that, you know, all the burdens are done. He doesn't have to worry about that. And then Sozen is saying, you're not done with it. You're not done with this world. So, let's look at another poem. This is one by Rumi. I wonder if we could just go around and read this poem. Dan, you want to read the first stanza? Let's go around and read a stanza. Who says these words with my mouth was the name of the poem.
Who says these words with my mouth? All day I think about it. Then at night I say it. Where did I come from, and what am I? What am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea. My soul is from elsewhere. I'm sure of that, and I intend to end up there. This drunkenness begun in some other tavern.
This drunkenness began in some other tavern. When I get back around to that place, I'll be completely sober. Meanwhile, I'm like a bird from another continent, sitting in the aviary. The day is coming when I fly off. But who is it? Who is it not in my ear who hears my voice? Who says words with my mouth?
Who looks out with my eyes? What is the soul? I cannot stop asking. If I could taste one sip of an answer, I could break out of this prison for drunks. I didn't come here out of my own accord, and I can't leave that way. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home.
It's poetry. You never know what I'm going to say. I don't plan it. When I'm outside the saying of it, I get very quiet and rarely speak at all.
Okay. That's kind of weird. What's he saying there about drunkenness? All day I think about it, not drunkenness, all day I think about it, and then at night I say it. Where did I come from? And what am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea. My soul is from elsewhere, I'm sure of that, and I intend to end up there. This drunkenness began in some other tavern, and when I get back around to that place, I'll be completely sober. Meanwhile, I'm like a bird from another continent, sitting in this aviary. The day is coming when I fly off, but who is it not in my ear who hears my voice? Who says words with my mouth? Who looks out with my eyes? What is the soul? I cannot stop asking. If I could taste one sip of an answer, I would break out of this prison for drunks. I didn't come here of my own accord, and I can't leave that way. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home. This poetry? I never know what I'm going to say. I don't plan. And when I'm outside the saying of it, I get very quiet and rarely speak at all. What do you think he's talking about there?
I like the part where when I'm outside of saying, that last part really ties in. Like this poetry that flows out of him, and so when he's outside of saying it, he gets very quiet and doesn't speak at all. So there's like this, not two sides, but maybe there's these sides of him where one is flowing and expressing, and then the other part is like when nothing comes to his mind, he just doesn't really write.
So it's, anybody have any other takes on that?
Well, it's interesting because his poems feel like a kind of enlightenment, and he's basically saying he's outside the saying of it.
Yeah.
So it's coming from elsewhere, which relates to this idea of the drunkenness began in some other tavern. What I can't understand reading this is that he'll be completely sober when he goes back.
Yeah. Well, that's the sort of theistic view of it.
Okay.
But he's, you know, Seize thinks he's completely sober. Seize says, okay, you know, I'm poor. And yet, can you help me? Perhaps thinking, I've got you stumped because there's no greater richness than my form of destitution. And yet, I think what Rumi is saying here is that I don't know what's going on. I say these poems during the day. They are a form of ecstatic drunkenness. And at night, when I'm quiet, I ask these questions. There's no way out of this drinking in this world. We're in this particular tavern, and the tavern that Seize is living in is still an imaginary tavern. And all of this is coming out of his emptiness. All of it is an expression of his enlightenment. The questions and the poetry are a form of drunkenness, but coming from beyond himself. So things move through us. We think we're in control. The ego is there, postulating, making sentences with subjects and objects in him. And who's in charge when you're really present?
Yeah, Rumi's poem gives you the sense of an intricate mixture that cannot be separated out, you know, completely intertwined and moving and constantly.
Yeah. So, I mean, he lived this really weird life where he spontaneously generated poems all day long. Thousands of them. Many, many thousands of them. And his collected poems are immense. And that's still just a fraction of them. A lot of them are done away with. And he was writing those poems when he felt alienated from God. And then he had this fellow named Shams, who he called the guest, who when he met Shams, then he felt like he was Shams showed him how to... He was like Mother Teresa. He was doing all this ecstatic poetry, but not feeling connected to it. And then Shams came in, and then bam, he was fully integrated. And then Shams left, but he was left with this, you know, he'd gotten it. He'd gotten what Shams had to give him. And therefore the guest becomes the liberator. It's referred to as the guest when the guest arrives. The guest is the person who comes in, or the event in our case, that comes and delivers us to ourselves, or to the self beyond the self, to our emptiness, to our enlightenment. So the last poem, the one I want to end with, is there's a couple more of my poems there, but I'm going with this one. It's called The Wine. So Merwin, who's just about Galway Canal's age, 87, still alive, and still writing poetry, and he wrote an incredible poem a couple weeks ago. It was in New York. He had a dream where he had his back to a blackboard, and the blackboard was his father, and the board had just been erased. And then he just meditated on that incredible image. So, the wine. With what joy I am carrying a case of wine up a mountain. Far behind me, others are being given their burdens, but I could not wait even for them. It is a wine I will not drink. I will not drink it, not I, this wine. A signpost is swinging around, up in the woods, in the fog. One way saying, almost. One way saying, punished. In another language I know. but no sign this way. By now, the stone railing is fog no longer. The dew brushed from the pine needles onto my fingers runs down into my armpits. How cold my arms are. How awkward the wine is to carry on my shoulder. That's part of the joy. So, you know, Merwin is a long-time practitioner of Zen, is a long-time student of Robert Aitken. And what do you think he's talking about with this wine?
His life.
His life, what he has to give, mm-hmm. what he has to give. So, I'm carrying this intoxicant up the mountain from my friends. But I'm not going to drink of it because it's what I have to do is to carry my particular form of intoxication, which was like Rumi's poems. All right? And it's no good if you drink it. Right? It's only good if you experience it as sort of the price of admissions to being a human being. So, you know, we have that phrase, how to have your cake and eat it too. And this thing is how to have your wine and not get drunk. That's where we are, I think. We live in a world which specializes in getting us drunk. Mm. And there's no way out of it, you know. I got intoxicated on Andre Agassi's anger. I got intoxicated by the pitcher for the San Francisco Giants at the end of the World Series. You know, I got intoxicated with anger at the idiot who runs the English department. And just unbelievable, just naked ego defending itself no matter what. And so I'm hooked. The question is how to live without being hooked.
The last time I was here, Peter talked about what he was talking about with let it go. And I didn't want to hear that. And when I heard in the Galway Canal thing that I really responded to is wanting this and not wanting to be that. Whatever this is, I want to see it. I want it, and I don't want to be somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And yet, there's the thing about what Peter said with let it go, which was really what I needed to hear then. Mm-hmm. And there's a tension between those two. Mm-hmm. There's a real tension there. Mm-hmm. I don't have much more to say, but it seems to be ground we're covering here on this. Hmm. Or maybe not, I don't know.
Well, that's the end of what I have to say. I'll just read the koan over again. I am solitary and poor. I beg you, Master, please help me to become prosperous. So Zan said, Venerable Seizei. Yes, Master, replied Seizei. San said, you've already drunk 3 cups of the Hakka wine, and still you say you have not yet moistened your lips? Which is, you know, really a beautiful thing to say to him. He's not slamming him. He's just pointing out, here we are, dude. One continuous mistake.
I have to say another aspect that's keeps coming up for me is that Rumi is saying that he got drunk in another tavern.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of the wine in another way, and again, I'm a new Buddhist, so.
Well, so Rumi's not a Buddhist. Yeah.
I'm totally teasing, but I'm thinking that the wine could be his life in the sense of offering, carrying up his life that he will not be tasting of it. He's climbing the mountain with his life, and he knows that it will not be for him to uncork that, but he can still climb it up the mountain. And others are carrying their burdens that they can offer up the mountain. That wine, in that sense, doesn't have to be temptation or blah, blah, blah. And that Rumi is saying he got drunk somewhere else. What's coming is he's bringing to us, you know, words of enlightenment. I mean, the guy is gushing awesomeness from another planet. This, he says, is his drunkenness. So I'm wondering whether that wine that this guy is carrying up the mountain could be a beautiful thing, not just something that he's going to carry but not taste in some way.
Sumptuous.
Let's go get drunk.
Sumptuous destitution.
I think, you know, I keep hearing just this, and this is beautiful.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
And the difficulty is part of the joy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm Jewish, but didn't Jesus have things with wine? Wasn't there a transformation going on?
Yeah, communion.
Yeah, he did.
Communion.
He did. And that's how most people experience their degree of at-one-ment with Jesus.
Okay.
Somebody said, I ran into this the other day, if it's working well, it's Jesus drinking Jesus.
Mm-hmm. So why unhook? You said, how do we live unhooked, not being hooked, you know?
Well, why don't you answer that yourself, my enlightened friend? At the other end of the life cycle.
I feel a struggle with that,
sure.
You know? Because, like, for me, like, being hooked is going to the city and, like, making money and looking good and making networks and stuff. And then unhooked is coming here and, you know, being in winter. I don't know yet.
So there's unhooking and there's unhooking, right?
And I like that. I don't know yet. Not knowing.
So you can just look at the first few words of the Why Regret poem. Push that a little further. You know, this is a poem he wrote late. It was in the New Yorker now, a couple of years ago. Didn't you like the way the ants help the peony globes open by eating off the glue? Weren't you cheered to see the ironworkers sitting on an I-beam dangling from a cable in a row? Like starlings eating lunch? Maybe with bologna on white and with fluorescent mustard? Wasn't it a revelation to swim all the way up from the estuary to the river, the kill, the stream, the run, the brook, the beck, the sod gone dry, to the shock of a spring? Didn't you almost shiver to hear the book lice ticking their sexual dissonance inside the old Webster's New International, having just eaten it out of it, the words izzle, zister, and thalassicon? So what did you imagine lay in store? And anyway, at the end of a world where the subsubstance is muck, birdlong, slime, mucus, bleed, food. So he goes on like that for a long way. And then he adds, you know, at the end of his life, he says, what does he say? Does somebody have that?
At the end of the poem?
Yeah, the end of the very last lines of the poem is,
Isn't it worth missing
whatever joy you might have dreamed to wake up in the night and find you and your beloved are holding hands in your sleep?
Yeah. So there's the tension, right? I want all that stuff, you know. I want to go to New York City and be in New York City. He lived in New York City and on a farm in Vermont. I once heard him read it. He came to Colby and read it in the museum, and he was covered with horse shit. And, you know, so he was very sophisticated, but he was very drawn to the yucky things, the lice. He said, because it's not all good. You have to see the whole thing. He wanted to say what is was. And he was very drawn to this debilitating thirst that he had for sex, essentially, as a sex addict. So, and then at the end, what's that, you know, was it all worth it? You know, would I have given that up to be holding my lover's hand at night? Wake up holding my lover's hand, that is, coming out of darkness into perfect love. He's asking the question, he's not answering it. So there's your answer. Mm. Ain't no answer.
Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it.